Accession number 27083, Reel 41.
Instead of having the 4 hours on, 4 hours off ordinary watchkeeping system broken by the dog watches in, down into two lots, you had 6 hours on and 6 hours off. And the reason behind it was that, whereas under the, as I still regard it, old-fashioned system, four on, four off, if anything serious happened, you had a sniff of the submarine or you came under air attack or whatever, you then went to action stations and the entire ship's company closed up. Now, viewed from the enemy's aspect, all the enemy had to do was to make an approach and be pretty sure you'd go to action stations, and then he'd haul off. And then he'd, some hours later, he'd make an approach, and then he'd fall off, and so on. And after 3 days or so of that, he would be dealing with a target which was absolutely knackered, and they were dropping in their tracks for lack of sleep. With the long watch system, as it came to be called, you did not go to action stations. And so you no longer had your so-called first 11 that you closed up whenever you went to action stations. You had, as it were, an A team constantly available. And this meant that the enemy could nip in and nip out and go on like that till the cars came home. But he wouldn't wear you down. And I was very taken with this. The trouble was that certainly the officer complement wasn't quite sufficient to permit this, certainly to my satisfaction. And the strain came on the commanding officer, because there wasn't, even if he worked as would normally be the case in a long watch organized trip, that the commanding officer would alternate with the second in command. And as an aside, they even went to the point in the carrier Eagle of appointing two commanders, executive commanders, and one was to work opposite the captain, and the other was to carry out all the normal admin business of the day that an executive officer does. And that didn't work entirely, and it never took on at all. I made it work because I trained myself to do with a minimum of sleep, and the length of an exercise was usually such that you could get by with that. But I was one officer short. With this in mind, knowing that I was going to recommission Galatea, which was, frankly, not a very clever bit of appointing, I don't think. And whether it was done to test me out, because I hadn't actually done a workup as a Captain D, not, in fact, that you worked up as a Captain D so much as working up your leader as an individual ship. I don't know, but that was it. And the timing was such that I was going to take the ship to Portland, work up, and then, which would take me to just about Christmas, and then early in the new year, I would hand over. It would have been very much better for all the ship, really, if the new commanding officer had worked the ship up at Portland, obviously, with a brand new ship's company. And very few, if any, of the previous ship's companies stayed on. Anyway, I was destined to go to take the ship to Portland to work up, and I had written to the flag officer sea training, and a couple of months back, knowing that roughly what the timing was, and made it quite clear that I wished to work the ship up on a long watch basis, to which they were not accustomed and hadn't done it before. And they acknowledged my letter, and they were very civil about it, and so forth. And while we were recommissioning, short period in, I went down to Portland to make quite sure that they'd got the message. And they had, but they weren't paying any attention to it because they thought that was just one of Leach's quirks. And I assured them that it wasn't, and that was how I intended to do it, and so forth. And they rather shrugged their shoulders and said things like, we'll sort all that when we get down to Portland. And that was that. The flag officer Steve Training at the time was a charming man. I think he was had been an RNVR during the war, called Philip Sharp, and a delightful man, but not, frankly, and I don't say this unduly critically, not a particularly strong personality. But the commander of Steve Training, who really was the, well, he was the chief of staff, as it were. They did have a separate chief of staff, but that didn't amount to all that. But he really ran the working up teams. And he was a man called, it slips my mind for a minute, but he was a very powerful personality, Cox, John Cox, who eventually became a vice admiral, I think, and so on. Well, the day came, and down we went to Portland, and that was fine. And I wasn't fussed about playing around and getting the feel of handling the ship, because I'd done all that, and it was much the same. I had a very young ship's company, very young. As I quickly came to realize, they were an excellent lot, super lot. But I had, as I recall, something like 85 under the age of 22, 23. And they got tired more quickly than older men would have done. And therefore it was terribly important that they did get a decent break for a square meal and have six sucking great potatoes on their plate to fill their guts before we went on to the next thing. And of course it was winter, it was November, December, and the weather was, to say the least, variable, and so on. Well, we started off, and the normal first couple of weeks or so in Portland for working up, they checked out the ship, and they checked out all the equipment, and you did a little bit of harbor training, shore training in teachers and so forth. And it was all important, but they were really checking that everything, including the philosophy of how you went about business and the organization of the ship, because that could vary a bit, ship to ship, that was on the right lines, and so on and so forth. And then you went to sea, and you, although you came in for the odd weekend, throughout a long working week, you were at sea. That was fine. And the first sea week that we went to, we joined in, and the Thursday, which came to be known during sea time there as Faust's Thursday War, and I'd made it quite clear that despite the shrugging their shoulders a bit, I was going to work my ship up on a long watch basis. And the Thursday came, and off we went, and they flung the book at me, and it was very intense. But maybe more by luck than good management, we managed to retain a grip on the various threats that they flung at us. And we knew what was going on, and we dealt with what was going on, and they were surprised, they were startled by this, and they were a bit, frankly, put out of joint. Well, the next thing that happened was that the following week they brought practically the entire workup staff on board to blitz me during another Thursday War sort of thing. And again, we got away with it. And then, at the request of the Commander Sea Training, I let them use my cabin, and they had a great sort of mumbo-jumbo conference down there as to what they were going to do, because they weren't used to this sort of thing. And when they were ready, and they spent most of the afternoon, we got on and did other exercises and so forth, but they spent most of the afternoon nattering in my cabin. And then the Commander Sea Training said that they were ready to talk. And I went down. And they said, well, the sense of what they said was, well, you can't go on like this. If everybody went on like this, I don't know how we would cope. Because we have to do the various bits of weaponry and so forth, rather as set pieces, in order to make sure that you go along the right lines and that sort of thing. And we're not here to teach tactics. But they had gone so far in that, in my judgment, wrong direction, that they were actually conducting certain situations in a fashion that was thoroughly, tactically unsound. And therefore they were injecting bad doctrine as opposed to good doctrine. And I say that harshly, because on the whole they were very good and very keen and very hard-working and so forth. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I hear what you have to say, but I will refer you to the first paragraph of the first page of your workup handbook, which says that the commanding officer is responsible for his ship's workup. And that is what I shall continue to enforce. And I just hope that you will continue to help me do it. And that was that. Well, we did. We had a good workup. And the final so-called inspection lasted 5 days, which was quite a long time. And that was everything by day and everything by night. And it was pretty exhausting and so forth. And we got through all that. And we came back into harbour, and I had the flag officer Sea Training himself on board for the final, whatever it was, 24 hours or so. And we got alongside in harbour at Portland, I suppose, at about 12:30, 1 o'clock sort of thing. And the Admiral left to go ashore and confer with his staff and said he'd be back at 2 o'clock. Which was the normal form there, to tell me as the commanding officer what he thought of me, and then to address the ship's company and very briefly tell them what he thought of them. And 2 o'clock came, and this now was very close on Christmas. It was in 20th of December or so. And it got dark early, and we were all very tired. We put our backs into it, and I wanted to go back to Portsmouth in daylight, because the Channel shipping by then had made things pretty cluttered and so forth, and I wanted to be able to get back to Portsmouth in daylight, shut down on the machinery, button up the shore supplies, and give the boys a break. And then half the time or so, they'd go off on their Christmas leave, which they very richly deserved. But 2 o'clock came, no sign of the Admiral, and 2:30, and so it went on. And 3 o'clock came, and still no sign of the Admiral. And I started ringing up. Oh, yes, he was almost ready to come. And I was hopping mad, frankly. And at about 4 o'clock, he came. By which time it was getting dark. And I took him into my cabin, and he told me what he thought of me, which was, bless him, reasonably complimentary. And then he said, of course, you're let down by your torpedo anti-submarine officer, your TAS officer. Now, I had, as my new TAS officer, a man called Guy Liardet, who eventually became a rear admiral. He was a very fine officer. He had a slight impediment in his speech. And when I hadn't met him prior to that commission, and I took him to one side after he'd been rather sort of stammering over the intercom, and said, "Now look, if you're faced when you've got the ship, if you're faced with a crisis, and you've got to say hard starboard or full ahead or something pretty dramatic like that, what happens if you can't get it out? And all you get is a hesitation," etc. And he looked me straight in the face. He said, "Sir, it doesn't happen like that. Whenever there is anything approaching a crisis, I don't have a problem. It's only when I'm just conducting an ordinary conversation that I sort of if and but, rather." I didn't believe a word of this, but I took him at his word, and on one or two occasions he proved the point. And here was this my superior officer, flag officer sea training, saying, you're let down by your TAS officer. And he went on a bit about this. And as I say, I was very tired. I was pretty cross that he'd delayed things so unnecessarily and so thoughtlessly coming on board, keeping the whole ship's company hanging around, and so forth. And finally I said, "Sir, what is the name of the officer to which you refer?" And he said, "Johnson." And I said, "Sir, I have not got any officer by that name on board this ship." And that sank him, of course. He had nothing else to say. I took him aft, and he spoke to the ship's company, and he spoke for far too long. He must have spoken the best part of 10 minutes, which is quite a long time. And I listened intently, and he waffled. And I really didn't know what he had said, but it wasn't particularly complimentary, and as I say, he waffled. And we saw him over the side, and we slipped, and we legged it for Portsmouth.
In the dark.
In the dark. And we went alongside in Portsmouth, and they had no shore power supplies, so we couldn't let the let the boilers die down and that sort of thing. We had to keep steam up, and so on. And I was furious. And we gave leave straight away, and so on. And I slept on this, and in the morning, the next morning, having slept on it, I summoned my first lieutenant and said that I wished to clear low deck and speak to the entire ship's company at midday. And I thought very carefully about this, because the last thing I wanted to do was to, shall I say, appear to be subversive to my ship's company concerning the flag officer sea training and what had gone on at Portland. And my new administrative authority, who was flag officer flotilla's home, was Michael Pollock, who I hadn't met since Newcastle days. And I made a signal to him, requesting to wait on him to make my number at whatever it was, 12:30 or so. And at midday, just before the sailors went to dinner, I spoke to the whole lot on the flight deck, and I told them what I thought of them. And I said that the previous night we'd been very tired. I was very tired too, and I knew that they were absolutely worn out. And I wasn't sure, quite, thinking back on it, what it was that the flag officer's training had said to them when he had addressed them again on the flight deck. But And since I wasn't too sure what he'd said, what message he was getting over, I could only suppose that maybe they weren't too sure either. So I would now tell them precisely what I thought of them, and I proceeded to do so. And they all knew that I was going to leave the ship a week or so after Christmas. And I told them straight out that I thought they were a very fine lot, that I would happily take them anywhere, at any time, to do anything and be confident that they'd come out on top. And that my greatest regret was that I would be leaving them a week after Christmas. And that was that. And 12:30, it's not for me to comment on how that went down, but I think they needed that because they deserved it, frankly. They were a very good lot. And at 12:30, I went across to my senior officer, Michael Pollock. And he took me down to the cutter. He was in a cruiser. And he said, we knew each other pretty well, of course, from previous commissions. And he said, you're very angry, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am, rather, sir. And he said, well, you better have a stiff glass of gin. And I had a stiff glass of gin. And he said, why are you so angry? And I told him. And I said that I thought it was really a disgraceful send-off from Portland when, by any standard, we'd done pretty well. And meantime, the signal had come through, reporting, and this went up to the Admiralty, and it went, of course, to him as my new administrative authority. And it said, I think I can recall the precise wording, Galatea has completed a satisfactory workup, but has yet to develop her full potential. Not a very remarkable thing to say about a ship that's only just commissioned and just worked up, because she probably hasn't developed her full potential, and so forth. We weren't far off it, I didn't think. And Michael Pollock said, well, I wasn't quite sure what this signal meant. And so I got my people to ring up Portland to find out. Oh, they said it meant that Henry Leach didn't agree with the way we went about our business. And that was that one. I left the ship. I handed over to a great personal friend, John Roberts, very early in January. And as soon as I left, I had to pay my farewell call on CNC Fleet. Sir John Frewin, who, as I think I had mentioned earlier, I had called on assuming command of, as Captain D, 27th Escort Squadron in Galatea. And he had then rather sat behind his desk and said, when you call on me at the start of your commission, I do the talking. And if you're kind enough, as if you had any option, to call on me at the end of your commission, you do the talking. And I remembered this, just about his precise words. And up I went. And I got into his office, and there he was sitting behind his desk. And he didn't take me over to a table or anything. He started talking. And he talked quite fast and quite long, and it was all good stuff, no doubt. And then he paused, and I seized on the break, and said, sir, may I remind you of something you said to me when I called on you when I first assumed command of Galatea and rehearsed what I've just repeated to you. Oh, he said. He had a rather sort of snarling voice. Oh, he said, do you mean you've got something to say? And I said, yes, sir, I have. Well, come on, boys, spit it out. And I said, well, sir, in the course of my 18 months in command, I have been visited once by the fleet cookery officer, twice, and by me, I or a ship in my squadron have been visited, and twice by the fleet catering officer, and not at all by any other fleet staff officer. Now, we've been out in the Mediterranean and so forth, but they didn't have such staff out there because it had run down and so on. And he glared at me and said, "You couldn't have said anything to hurt me more." And I realized I was in for trouble. And so I said, "Well, sir, I'm sorry. It was not my intention to hurt you. But if I, as one of your captains, can't tell you the facts of life at sea, then how are you ever going to hear about it?" And he was furious. And he pressed the buzzer and summoned his secretary, who was a splendid paymaster captain called Jack Asbury, and talking across me to his secretary, said, "Jack, here's Captain Leach says what I just told you. Now go and check it out." Which was tantamount to my face to say that I was a bloody liar. I didn't care for it. And 10 or 15 minutes later, the secretary came back and said, "Sir, I have researched what you asked me to, and I'm informed that records are not kept of staff visits to the ships of the fleet. But from what I can make out, what Captain Leach has said is correct." And that was that. Well, he then took me off to lunch in a slightly strained atmosphere, to say the least. And I had a good lunch. And that was that. And I had some leave due then. And then I was appointed to a thing called the Senior Officers' War Course, following which I was to go as director of the Tattergall School, a job that I greatly looked forward to because there was quite a bit of Tattergall thinking that I thought was had become somewhat outdated. The Senior Officers' War Course was 5 months only. It consisted of, it was tri-service, but unlike the much more fashionable and much better known Imperial Defence College course, which, because it had a lot of Commonwealth and other people on it, had a top security grading of confidential. But the Senior Officers' War Course went up to top secret. And the odds and sods, so to speak, were simply our own UK services. And that was that.
No overseas people?
No overseas people at all, no.
Okay.
How are we going?